Go ahead and get started. Our next speaker is Lynn Cinto. He's going to talk to us about Tree Island development at the Loxahatchee Impoundment Experiment.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for all for coming. Good. Thanks. Cool. Okay. Right. Hi. My name is Lynn Cinto. I'm at FIU, and we have this project called LILA, Loxahatchee Impoundment Landscape Assessment. We acronym for is LILA. That we run, we do experiments out there. The project is run by the South Florida Water Management District, and in the abstract, but didn't make it to the slide, is actually Tom Dreschel, Eric Klein, and Fred Sklar, who are co-authors on a lot of this work and almost all of it, because we work pretty closely with them. So what we're going to do today is talk about some of our experiments. I'm kind of an overview of some of the work, mostly done by graduate students and postdocs, and a couple of them are Alexander Cerna and Andres Rodriguez are in the audience here today. I'm just kind of taking their work. So we're going to talk about soil, water, and vegetation interactions, basically on created tree islands at LILA, and how we're using it as a physical model for Everglades restoration. And then I just hit the page there. Yeah, okay. So you may have all seen this. This is a widely used image from the Mitchigaslink Wetlands book. And basically what it's talking about is just that in the development of the of a wetland ecosystem, we have... Can you guys hear me if I just talk like this? Yeah, okay. So basically we have this hydrology. We have this movement of water, this inundation frequency, the frequency, the depth, the flow of the water. And that influences both the physical chemical environment, things like the soil chemistry, right, and the biota. And then the things that grow there, right, as we know, wetlands are dominated by hydrophytes. Well, that biota then does also have feedback. And that biota then takes and influences the soils that build up in the wetland area, right? And then the water and soil determine somewhat the biota that forms there. So what we're going to be talking about is kind of these things, hydrology, biota, and soil development, the physical chemical environment of soil, on a couple of created tree islands in a created wetland and Everglades physical model called LILA. So one of the reasons that this has prompted this was that there's been a great loss in the extent and size of tree islands. And Tom talked a little bit about it, and I actually have some picture of the Dunedin in here also. Tom was just talking about the loss in tree island carbon in tree islands. And so if we take some of this is some published work, and we look at basically estimates of the losses in tree islands since the 50s. This is water conservation area 3. About 61% of the total surface area of the tree islands have been lost, and even greater in 2A. Most of that loss has occurred in small tree islands, those less than about 3.2 hectares. And the other thing that you can notice by these maps, and these are just images of maps, is that the patch density has greatly decreased. So you might imagine that if you're like a terrestrial fauna, like a deer, right, and you don't like your feet in water all the time, now you have to travel really long distances between tree islands to get up and out, to get on those topographic highs. So we've seen a tremendous loss in tree island. And it's thought that it's been due to, you know, our loss in hydrologic diversity, the sustained high or low water conditions that come with, you know, impounding these large areas of the Everglades. I think most people in here are familiar with the alterations of the Everglades system over the years. Okay, good, yeah. Okay, and this is what's referred to commonly as a ghost tree island. And this is that same image that Tom was talking about. In fact, these are district slides. The Dunedin Island. And so what once harbored a forest of hammock species now is largely willow, if there at all. Right, so Tom's talking about that. So we've seen a great loss in tree islands, and these are very important habitats in the Everglades, such that they are an important component of SERP, the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, and also the newer iteration of that, the Central Everglades Planning Project. One of the ideas in these projects is that we're going to decompartmentalize a lot of the Everglades and try to bring back natural flow, and then will that natural flow help lead to the reestablishment and greater health health of the existing tree lands and potentially reestablishment of other new tree islands. So one of the things we're trying to do with this, and one of the plans in this is potentially to backfill some of these canals, like the Miami Canal, the L67, to increase that kind of sheet flow. But one of the ideas may be that when you put in plugs in these canals, can you build topographic highs? Okay, if you build them as topographic highs, can you help reestablish tree islands? So one of the things we're doing is we're trying to evaluate, to some extent, whether something like this is a feasible restoration activity, but also in a more, I guess, scientific context, is to see if we can identify some of the processes that occur in tree islands, things like ion pumping, soil development, what species grow where. So the district, in cooperation with the Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, built LILA, the Loxahatchee Impoundment Landscape Assessment. It's located here on the Arthur R. Marshall National Wildlife Refuge property. This is about West Palm Beach is here. So this is Water Conservation Area 1. It's a living laboratory, or we call a physical model. It's semi-controlled. We can, and I'll show you, we can manipulate the water levels somewhat. And to an extent flow, water moving through it. The overall objective of the project is to reduce some of the uncertainty in these kind of SERP planning projects. Can we see how water management, what response tree islands, ridges, and sloughs, plant communities are going to have to variations in water management? And then what kind of water management what we need to ensure the maintenance of tree islands, that tree islands and ridges stay elevated above the sloughs, right? We don't want this homogeneity of the wetland surface. And additionally, since it is accessible at the refuge, the park headquarters there, people can actually get to it, walk around it, and see it. And so it's kind of an example of Everglades restoration in progress, an attainable site. It's a physical model. I just use this as an example. You know, this is this guy's physical model of you know, a stream channel and stream banks, you know, a meandering stream. So you can think of that as kind of a physical model of hydrologic model that he's looking at. And this is ours, okay? So this is one of four 8-hectare mesocosms out in LILA. And we have a ridge, a deep slough, a shallow slough, and two kind of created tree islands. And the idea is that these mimic this in the environment. Tree islands, our sloughs, and our ridges. So we've represented three of the major topographical features of the marsh habitat. Okay, this is adapted from a paper Laurel Larson published a few years ago that basically looked at the equilibrium conditions for tree islands and ridges in the Everglades. And we are interested in looking at basically how the hydrologic effects kind of define the equilibrium between decomposition and production and how that's related to hydrology, right? So we're looking at this soil development as related to hydrology, and then how that leads to an overall increase or decrease in topography, right, to maintain this elevation above the slough. So I'm going to move around on this a little bit. So she had this carbon flux here, and then she had the elevation of the surface relative to the water level, a decomposition line here, and then a production line here. So as you're getting, as you get into basically shallower water or your topography is raised above the slough surface, you get an increase in biomass, right? You get an increase in production. But you also get a bit of an increase in decomposition because you're not as inundated, you're not as reduced, more oxygen availability. So somewhere this is the sweet spot, say, for a tree island. It's initiated here. And then at some point here, you're at equilibrium where your production goes down, your decomposition goes up, and so you're not going to change your elevation very much. So what we wanted to do is we want to take that basic model and we wanted to add empirical studies and empirical data to it. So we looked at this decomposition. We looked at it in terms of litter decomposition and soil respiration. We want to look at this production line. So we looked at it in terms of biomass produced of trees per area and the amount of litter that fall that adds to the soil surface. The difference between the decomposition and the production we're considering is accretion, the amount of soil that accretes. And we're looking at feldspar markers to measure the accretion. And then this overall change in elevation, either up or down, we're measuring by surface elevation tables or sets. So that's basically the gist of what I'm going to talk about. This is what Lila looked like in 2000 before construction, maybe a little after that. But so these were fields they had at one time for about 20 or so years, were part of an active agriculture. When they made locks, they took them out of agriculture but still maintained them as impoundments. This is what it looked like very soon after land forming. Basically, the ridges were not changed. The surface of the ridge soil was the surface of the impoundment before earth moving. The shallow slough was dropped down 20 centimeters below that, and then the deep slough 45 centimeters below that. And the material in the deep slough was actually piled up to make these tree islands, which rise 90 centimeters above the slough bottom. Some of the tree islands were built with a lime rock core, and some are completely peat. You can probably actually see it here. And that's to mimic both types of tree islands, generally the wholly organic islands, peat soil islands of the northern Everglades, and the lime rock anchored islands of the southern Everglades. Here's an aerial image, and so we have some that are completely peat cores and some that have lime rock cores, but at the low elevations they are also peat. Okay. And that's just what one looked like as it was being built. So this is what the site looks like. We don't take water from locks. We basically recirculate our water because some of the canal water has higher nutrients, and we didn't want a nutrient effect. We want to look at just hydrology. Now, we've done some studies with nutrients, but we do those in a fertilization experiments. So we're not flooding the area with high P water. We're just recirculating our water through the system, and we have some storage reservoirs we bring water in. So basically, water flows through the system. Cells 2 and 4 are maintained in flowing conditions where we bring the stage up to a certain level according to a hydrograph I'll show you. And we maintain it there but in a flowing condition. Whereas 1 and 3, we bring the water up to a level on about a 2-week interval and then we shut the gates and so they don't flow. And we get average velocities about half a centimeter per second in our flowing cells. So this is a cross section of the landscape. You can see here's our shallow slough, our ridges, our deep slough, and then our mounded tree islands. We have two areas that we'll be talking about today. The head high is at the highest elevation on the tree island, and the head low, which is about half slope down. And then we get different. So the differences in topography and the differences in hydrograph, our water stage, determines the periods of inundation at any point in Lila. This is basically our rainfall and our water levels. These bold lines are actually our target hydrograph. And you can see, you know, a little bit of trouble in the beginning, but then we got really good at managing water. We had a couple of droughts and a couple of flood conditions. So here again, 2000 to 2003. This is what the islands look like in 2006. When we planted cells 1 and 4, we couldn't get enough trees to plant all the islands at the same year. So we had to plant two mesocosms in one year and two in the next year. But in 2006, they were bare. Each of these different colors represents a different tree species planted randomly across the landscape at four different planting densities. So we can look at the effects of tree density. And then this is basically what they look like now. So in just a few years, they've actually filled in. And we've kind of been monitoring changes in conditions as we've gone. I got to pick up a little bit. 2008, 2010. And again, this is a physical model. And one of the things we wanted to do with the hydrology, one of the things we've done is we did a dye study, and we have a student who is actually modeling surface water hydrology. And so she calibrates her surface water models based on some of the dye studies we've done at Lila. And you can see, although not exact, her model actually does a pretty good... Lila is acting... Well, her model or Lila are pretty good models of being able to look at surface water hydrology. So Tom was alluding to this a little bit, too, about higher concentrations of phosphorus. Now, not this island doesn't have as high concentration as he was talking about, but this is from a paper, Wetzel 2005, where they look at tree island structure, and some of the ways that these hot spots, or this biogeochemical hot spots could form. Basically, there is an elevation difference within a tree island. The heads are the high spot, sloping down to the tail. And that usually mimics a gradient in phosphorus, going from very high in the head to lower in the tail, but certainly much higher than the soil phosphorus concentrations in the marsh. And for that, tree islands are considered biogeochemical hotspots. They contain a lot of nutrients, but they have a very small spatial extent. So you can imagine these things as like little chemical spots in the landscape. Now, how did all that phosphorus get in there? Well, some of the ways may be that growing trees are not just using this low P water in the low P water in most of the natural Everglades and bringing the water in this way, but they're actually using ion-enriched, high phosphorus-enriched water from the ground because of the transpiration, the differential transpiration, right? So they're ion pumping, okay? As well as, you know, maybe bird guano and other things. So one of the things you want to look at is see if this mechanism exists. Now remember, these are created tree islands that are only a couple years old. So the first thing, one of the first things we did was establish a number of wells, surface and groundwater wells, to look at the differences in water levels, and then sampled those wells also for nutrients. And this is Pam Sullivan's work. And basically, when the islands were young, rain fell on them, the water moved off the topographic high into the surface water. Like that. Okay, but as the tree islands developed, the trees got bigger, the trees started transpiring and pulling actually groundwater into the tree islands. Right? So actually pulling water into this portion of the tree island and using some of this deeper groundwater. And that effect was greater where they had lime rock cores than the peat cores, but still occurring in the peats also. So if you look at, this is just some chloride data and oxygen isotopes, surface water, the groundwater in the slough and rainwater, and then this is the groundwater in the tree island. If you were just to look at evaporation, you might expect this line in your isotopic in your ions, but really the tree islands did this. So the effect of transpiration over time got greater, and the water in the center of the islands where this evaporation is or evapotranspiration is occurring is very different than the water in the slough, and basically the chloride concentrations and other ions as chlorides as tracer are 5 minutes really. Wow. Okay. Then I'm going to go through this really quick. We also planted trees in different density patterns, different species. As you might imagine, both growth and biomass were greater in drier conditions. And one of the things we just did is we wanted to see how species, the red species especially, are typical upland species versus the wetter species. So we were able to identify the mortality at a relative water level for our trees out at Lila. And that's pretty, those lines. So we developed water optima for different species of trees. Okay, so now this is what I really wanted to talk about. So we wanted to fit empirical data to that model. So we're trying to develop a carbon model between soil building and respiration. And this work is actually detailed in a poster by Dr. Serna. It's 157.3, and then Andres is 157.4 following this. We looked at carbon accumulation as a balance between above-ground biomass litter traps, collecting litter, decomposition of it, overall efflux of CO2, soil accretion, and the whole thing by a change in elevation. And we figured that the accumulation is the balance between this production and respiration, and that where trees were greatest, litter fall would be greatest, and therefore accretion would be greatest. But also that at the higher elevations, efflux and decomposition would be greater. And so we were trying to look at the balance of this. And if the balance is towards production, we'll get a higher island than a lower. So the other thing we had is we know the location of every tree. We know the elevation of every tree. All of our points are geo-rectified so that we can tell what's going on in the areas surrounding them. These are our litter traps, our feldspar markers. And that's the DEM, or digital elevation model. So we know the elevation at any point, and therefore we can get its period of inundation. And so if we first look at the litter production, we see that it was somewhat affected by elevation. The blue is at the head high of that top, and the green is at the head low. So it seems, you know, generally the blue is, the blues are greater than the green. So where we get greater production of biomass, we also get greater litter fall. But the decomposition from the litter bags wasn't different. We would have thought that decomposition would have been slower in the wetter, in the head lows, and it wasn't. Generally, we didn't see, maybe here a little bit, we didn't see that there was this much greater decomposition in the lower elevations, which we thought we would have. We measured CO2 efflux using a LICOR, LI8100, and we had the periods of measurements on the hydrograph. Basically, we did show that there was an effect of flooding. Reduced efflux under flooded conditions, drier conditions, more soil CO2 efflux as might be expected. And our measurements of respiration and efflux match pretty well with what you see in the literature. And they were highly correlated to both litter fall and biomass. So where you have bigger trees and more litter, you get greater efflux. We looked at the soil accretion. The head high is a bit greater than the head lows, although not significant. And this is the amount of soil in the 3-4 year period we were measuring since 2009 on top of the feldspar. This is what it looks like. We were getting about 3 centimeters of soil building, which is actually kind of rapid. Organic matter content in the new soil, this is Andre's work, was greater than in the older soil, the soil that it was built out of. So we separated soil. We figured out that 2.5 was like 0 to 3, and then 3 to 10 was the unaffected soil, or not new soil. And it had higher organic matter, higher total phosphorus, higher total nitrogen, all correlated to the organic matter. And then he looked at available P. Unlike what Dr. Reddy was talking about earlier, the available P was actually a very small fraction of the total P, but the available P, as determined from water-soluble phosphorus and sodium chloride extractable phosphorus, was significantly higher in the newly accreting soil than in the soil it was created from. So this just shows that, you know, here's the high density, where the trees were maximally productive and litter fall was highest, the 0 to 3 was higher in TP, the lower density producing less litter, a little bit lower, and then the older soil. Same thing with the available P. And this is on his poster, 157-4. We measured surface elevations using these sets, and we basically see that although we're accreting soil, the islands are sinking. And if we put that together, our vertical accretion, you know, here is like 2.9 and 2.5, but our loss is still -2 and 0.5. And if we balance that all out, even though we've seen accretion, accretion of soil at the surface, the whole things are sinking such that if you add those together, our islands are still subsiding at about a net loss of 3.5 centimeters. We've put this in, this is part of Alexander's work, so you'll see this in a little bit of detail. So we tried to do a carbon balance in grams carbon per meter squared per year, and our respiration is just really much higher than our accumulation. Now, I'm not sure that that's where all the subsidence is. It could be that these islands are just packing down. But one of the things this is kind of showing is that we're still losing elevation even though we're building soils. I think Solila is a useful physical model of the Everglades. We were able to quantify tree growth and survival. Although we can't mimic a tree island, we at least look at our processes are along the trajectories we would expect. Well, soil accretion is a little, just less than 1 centimeter per year. So we might have to keep that in the mind when we're looking at growing tree islands. I guess I don't know if anyone. Thank you.